Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's so many good things to talk about today. I know that a lot of you, however, are still cleaning up. You know, it wasn't supposed to be that bad. I think, my evil twin, as we like to call him, had 14 inches of rain out at his nursery in Sims. Oh, boy. A serious thing, but he's pulling it out. He's making it work, doing good. I know that a lot of folks in Baldwin County had some power outages, kind of odd. And of course, as you get deeper into Mississippi, on the other side of the boot heel, I think there was some serious flooding. So we should talk about that today. I did want to make that the subject because there's a lot of confusion about what flooding means from hurricanes, as if there's some kind of special that hurricanes bring in some kind of special rain. Well, it's special only because there's a lot of it. Ain't special in any other way. Hurricane rain is rain, just pure old rain. Ain't no salt in it. There ain't no cooties out of the tropics. It's just rain. And the problem is, of course, that it it's too much. And we don't think about plants drowning, but plants drown, just like people drown. Plants may not be quite so dramatic about it, if I can say so. But let me say, they do drown, and they drown for peculiar reasons, and we don't think about it, but let's go back, because it's really important. It's really important for you to understand. Going forward, plants drown because they can't breathe. Just like, duh. You got to figure that, right? But you're looking at your plants, and they got all their there's the stem above the ground, all the leaves are above the ground, the flowers are above the ground. There ain't no water. The waters are seeded, but you know what? They're still drowning. And you say, well, that ain't so, because, it is. And here's why: plants breathe. But where do plants breathe? Let's talk about that for a second. Leanna, where do plants breathe? I won't make Leanna say. Plants breathe all over. They breathe in the leaves. They got little bitty teeny tiny mouths in the leaves that open and close. Thousands of them in each leaf. I don't know that they make that kind of sound, but you can kind of imagine it. They're just opening all the time. They're breathing through there, essentially. Exhaling, mostly. But doing other kinds of respiration through their mouths there. So they're breathing through their leaves. But, this is what you're not thinking about, because you don't see it, and you quit thinking about it. Plants breathe all over. And part of that all over is the roots. Roots. Plants got roots. They got things below ground. They got a lot of things below ground. Those roots do a lot of things. They anchor the plant. Yeah, that's right. But they're also the conductors of moisture into the plant. So plants get their moisture from the roots, right? And the roots have to serve as a way to draw that water up. But they get other things from the roots as well. And the roots have to breathe just like the leaves have to breathe. A little different mechanism, but they both have to breathe. So the roots and all the things that support the roots, and there are lots of things underground that support roots, they all got to breathe. They all got to exhale carbon dioxide. They got to inhale oxygen. That's mostly what happens below ground. A little different than above ground, but that's what happens. But what happens when the ground fills up with water, which it does all those little spaces between the soil particles, they fill up with water. There ain't no oxygen. There ain't no way to exhale either. Both of those things are big problems. And that's why plants drown. And that's what's happening now for a lot of people's plants. So those plants are going to start wilting. And they're going to wilt because they actually can't absorb water anymore because the roots are beginning to fall apart. So the whole plant structure is wilting because the roots are dying from too much water. They're drowning. And they can't function to pull water up into the plant anymore. Plant can't stay turgid, can't stay, you know, water is a big part of the bones of a plant. So it just wilts. And you're thinking, oh my goodness, this plant's dying from drought. I got to water it. Yow. You see what I'm saying? It's wise to understand that plants breathe all over. Most of the problems we have with plants in Alabama aren't the result of drought. They're really the result of too much moisture. It affects the way the soils function. It affects the texture of the soils, how much water can get into the soils. The heavier those rains and the more you go and pound them down with your car or your mowing tractor or your feet or whatever during wet periods, the less water it can absorb. The more likely it's going to saturate, and the more likely your plants are going to die from drowning. Things to think about. This is what happens. Listen, some quick lessons right now that you need to think about as you're looking at your yard. Don't try to wash off the salt because there ain't no salt. I mean, some people get salt spray, but there was plenty of rain. The spray is just from waves crashing and mist over the ocean. It isn't from the rain. The rain itself will have washed off most of the salts that are significant because everybody who had any salt spray, which would only be very close to the coast, anybody who had that problem, they had plenty of rain too. Don't worry about why. There ain't no salts. That is not an issue. Don't water. If your plants are wilting now, we need to talk about it. We need to figure it out. I'm not sure we can change things because it's hard to pump all the water out of the soils. It's hard to reverse the damage that occurs when plants start drowning. We can talk about how that damage accumulates. It's not just that the roots are weakened by drowning. It's suddenly it empowers all of the worst things in the soil. Things like the thing that we call destroyer of plants, Phytophthora. That's what literally Phytophthora means. It's a water mold. It loves this excess moisture. It's going to start working on plant roots. Pythiums are going to start working on plant roots. Bacteria of various kinds that thrive in low oxygen, very wet conditions, they're going to start working on plant roots. And it's hard to reverse that right now. But you can make it worse. You can make it worse by not understanding what's happening. So there it is. That's it in a nutshell. That's what we got to think about after this storm. We can also talk about how to make your yard less susceptible to these kinds of problems. And that is something you need to think about every day on the Gulf Coast because it is the primary obstacle to good gardening, particularly on the Gulf Coast, but even inland and over most of Alabama where we get these heavy rains. Heavy rains are the causes of most of our problems in gardens. Even when plants die from drought, it's usually because they've been weakened by heavy rains and can't tolerate even short periods of dry weather because they've been so weakened. How do we fix that? By understanding that we need to keep oxygen in the soil, that we need to allow the soil to infiltrate as much water without saturating the soil. These are the things we talk about a lot. These are the simple things to do, but you got to understand what's going on. You got to see what's happening underneath the ground there. And then you can fix it. So we'll talk about that this morning. Oh, man, I want to talk about, you know, this gumbo thing. Mike and Stu, you think I'm not going to take up that gumbo challenge? We're going to take up the gumbo challenge. We're going to talk about gumbo. We're going to talk about gumbo and what it tells us about how we think about where we are, how we think about the seasons, how we forget about how important seasons are to the garden and to our food. And yes, to gumbo. Seasons. So we're going to be talking about all those things this morning. Give us a call this morning. We'd love to hear from you. You can text us. You can call us. We'll love to answer your questions.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, that's enough. Let's back off here. Let's get on with the show. Some of you think, oh, you'd be so wrong. You would be so wrong. Some of you think, I don't remember the phone number to call in, but I do. 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. That's the number you call. Gee, Willie, sometimes you get all wound up. Get all kind of numbers in your head. But there it is, 251-343-0106. Listen, here, the cool thing about that number is you can text me a picture. You can text me a picture at that number, and I can sort it out. You can also ask me a question, and that's okay, too. That's okay, too. But sometimes I got to do a follow-up question, and sometimes it's better for you to call in. It's better to call in because, you know, sometimes, we ask the wrong questions. And sometimes I need to know a little bit more about what you need and what you want. And everybody asks me, you know, well, what do I do here? And I need to say, first off, well, what do you want? What do you like? That's important. When things go wrong, I got to say, well, where do you live? What's in that area? You know, what'd you do there? These are all important questions. Important questions. So I said I'm going to do the gumbo thing. I'm going to do the gumbo thing just because nobody's going to stop me right now. I talked about it a little bit with Mike Steve. Gumbo is one of those things. I don't want to argue about gumbo, except that I want to say, gumbo, if you understand it, is about seasons. And when you understand that gumbo is about seasons, that means every gumbo's okay. Well, some may not taste as good as others. Some may not be as well-developed as others. But basically, gumbo is a thickened stew, right? With some Gulf Coast elements. But the important thing to remember, and this is the fun part, this teaches you about gardening. Gumbo teaches you about gardening. When you understand the history of gumbo, there's filet gumbo, there's okra gumbo, there's gumbo with a roux. Which one's right? Which one's authentic? They're all authentic. And the reason they're all authentic is because each type of gumbo responds to seasons and to the availability of produce. We are now used to getting everything out of the freezer, right? Go to the grocery store, get your gumbo out of the freezer in January. Oh, my goodness. In the old days, people said, you know, we eat with the seasons. We live with the seasons. We eat what December brings us. And December don't bring gumbo. Neither does January, February, March, April. They didn't bring gumbo. Didn't have gumbo. That was a great time to have gumbo. Man, if you were, you didn't have okra. You didn't have okra during those times. You had gumbo. It was a great time for gumbo. But where are you going to get your okra? Well, you didn't have okra. And that, that was not a problem because the other, there are two traditions that come into early gumbos. One comes from the Choctaw and the allied tribes along the Gulf Coast, and they had something called filet, which were sassafras leaves. And sassafras leaves would get ground up. They would add it to the, they would add it to the stews at the end, thicken the stews up just like adding gumbo, right? You didn't miss the gumbo then. You didn't need the gumbo. The stew was thickened up otherwise. Sometimes you had fats. That was a European tradition too. So you get a European tradition, an African tradition, and a Native American tradition, all combining in gumbo, all three different traditions, all being used based on what seasons. And I think in spring, my bet is even the filet powder ran out. That's when it would be nice to have, you could make a roux with some wheat flour and some fats, make a thickener that way. They're all okay. They're all responses to seasons and to what was available. That's the cool thing about gumbo. So when somebody tells you, oh, you got to make your gumbo with this in it, well, sure you can. But gumbo was seasonal. Green gumbo, seasonal thing. March, April, May, when all the greens were coming in, you want to make sure you had the most, as many different, it's a spring tonic, many different kinds of greens as you possibly could get in there. And that says something about gardening. So, you know, if you're not understanding that gardening is about having lots of things in season, you had your tomatoes maybe earlier in the year. You got your okra coming in now. You got your eggplants coming in now. You got plenty of peppers. Man, if you did it right, you got peas. You're going to have butter beans coming in. You don't have those in spring. You got other things in spring. You got your mustard greens. You got your collards. You see what I'm saying? You got your peas. That's the way it works. Different seasons. I hate recipes that say you got to put, these are the vegetables you put in there. You put, you use these vegetables. And that's what my, no, that ain't a good recipe. The recipe says, look, whatever, take whatever vegetables you got. Think about how they might taste good together. And here's the basic way to put them together. You need a thickener. That's a beautiful thing about gumbo, is there ain't no recipe for it. You just need a thickener. You might want to char your vegetables. You can before you put them in. It's a really nice thing. Whatever's coming out of the Gulf, whatever came out of the creek in back of your house, whatever came out of the woods, that's what you put in there, right? That's the way gumbo should work. That's the way the seasons work. Good thing. Changes with the seasons. So should you. So should you. Hey, Barry said to me back in June, Barry, thank you for doing this. Back in June, folks were asking about bulbs, about buying bulbs. And I said, look, call me in September. Let's talk about it in September. It's September, folks. It's now time to talk. Listen, here's the thing about planting spring bulbs. There are a lot of them that work well on the Gulf Coast. Not all bulbs that are available are going to work well on the Gulf Coast. I'm going to send you to a few places, Old House Gardens, one of those places, great bulbs, a few other places that might have some bulbs for the Gulf Coast. I'm going to tell you about what they are. If you're interested, if you're ready to write them down, you call me. Get your pencil ready. Get your paper ready. Let's talk about what they are. But this is the time to order them. This is the time to order garlic. This is the time to order bulbs. This is the time. Because folks up north are going to be ordering those bulbs like crazy. You want the best selection of garlic? You want the best selection of bulbs? You got to get your order in now. As soon as possible. Because they'll be sold out by October. You're going to plant those bulbs in October and November. You don't have to have them come in right away, but you got to order them now. So this is something we're going to think about, something we're going to talk about. You know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about particular varieties right now unless it's on your mind, but you go to look at, you go through the catalogs, you look at the bulbs, you call me, let's talk about what varieties of bulbs do you want to order. Let's see if they work on the Gulf Coast. You really want bulbs that are going to work in zone 8 and zone 9. That's what the catalogs will say. It's kind of a squirrely terminology, but that's what they'll say. You really want the ones that are going to work well down south that don't need a lot of winter chilling. They don't need a lot of winter chilling if you're going to grow them south of Montgomery. North of Montgomery, you got a little more latitude with the catalogs at any rate. North of Montgomery, you probably can't grow some of the things that folks on the Gulf Coast can grow really well. But you can grow other bulbs that are more common in catalogs. So we can talk about that too. You got to understand where you are. You got to understand that those bulbs need winter chilling. But the big thing you got to understand is if you're going to have spring bulbs, you got to plant them now. And that's the ones that bloom in spring. The ones that bloom in summer, plant anytime. You can plant them when they're available. But this is when those spring bulbs are going to be available. This is when you want to put them in the ground. You don't mess with the refrigerator. You don't do anything like that. You just get the bulbs in October, November. You order them now. You get them in October, November, and you plant them out. This is the time to do it. This is the time to do it. I'd love to. So garlic's a bulb. Onions are bulbs. All those things are bulbing plants. With the onions, you probably need to order them now. You can order shallots, too. I have had off and on success with those, but you definitely want to order your seeds now and get them started. Hey, we're going to be back. 251. Listen to this, Leanna. 343-0106.
I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go. I'll get down on your bended knee.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. I'm just enjoying looking through my bulb catalog, thanks to Bruce. Thought, you know, I'll check it out and see what's available this year. I need to order some bulbs. Glad Bruce reminded us all. September's the time to do it. Let me tell you, here's a good place to start. There's a couple things you need to know about bulbs, and I always make this case with things like narcissus and jonquils and daffodils. It's very interesting that when these bulbs were first introduced to North America, it was the South where they were grown. The South was best known for them. We could grow more different kinds that were available then than any place else, and people up north got a little jealous. So a lot of the breeding effort, as with roses, went into making bulbs and roses available to more northern climates and making them more cold hardy. That meant we kind of got left out in the cold, so to speak, by the cold. Left out by the cold would be the way to say it. A lot of the bulbs that are sold in a lot of catalogs that you're getting from Michigan Bulb Catalog, et cetera, you know those things. You get them in the mail, they don't do well here. One of the catalogs that's been pretty good over the years, my good friend Scott Kunst developed it. He became my good friend because we were talking about bulbs. And Scott was asking me questions about bulbs in the South, and he was discovering that a lot of the old bulbs for his catalog, because he has the catalog oldhousegardens.com, write that down, oldhousegardens.com, were from the South. And so we shared the stories of the history of bulbs. And Scott is one of the few catalogs that actually had, the Old House Gardens was one of the few catalogs that made an effort to preserve those bulbs that did really well in the South. Scott has sold the catalog to his employees. I think that's how it worked. It's still growing strong. It looks beautiful. They got a great little catalog here. They've got a lot of plants in the catalog. It's Old House Gardens. It's traditional bulbs from all over the country. that did well, that were, you know, that would do well in various parts of the country. You want to look for those bulbs that do well in, they have a good system for doing this, 8B, 9A, or 9B. And these are, there's a lot of them in here. Avalanche is a great one. Avalanche daffodil. Carlton daffodil. If you want a classic large daffodil, Carlton, beautiful yellow, great, does great along the Gulf Coast and throughout Alabama. Really good one. Early Cheer is another one that does great. Early Cheer, E-R-L-I-C-H-E-E-R, Early Cheer. I think that's how we're going to say it. Grand Primo is one of my favorites. I love Grand Primo. It's one of the classic daffodils of Mobile yards. Been around for a long time. They're really, really great for us. Grand Primo daffodils, beautiful thing, wonderful thing. Grand Primo, a great one to have. It does really well for us. What else is in here? I'm going to look through. He's got Thalia, which does very well. It does very well on the Gulf Coast. It blooms later than some of the others, but it's one of the few later blooming daffodils that you can really trust. Tenby daffodil does pretty good over most of Alabama. In fact, you see it growing wild in a lot of places. It's kind of one of those wild daffodils, really beautiful things. Wild, by that I mean it's naturalized. It persists around old home sites and grows there for years and years and years. Doesn't spread in any kind of wild way, just kind of hangs around old house sites. But you'll see it sometimes. The cows eat around it because Narcissus foliage is toxic a little bit. So there's some of the varieties you can get from them. And there are others. The farther north in Alabama, the more choices you have out of this catalog and most catalogs nowadays. But there are some great ones that work even for us. King Alfred, he's got that one back. You know, that'll work really well in North Alabama. So it's fun to look through the catalog. Really fun to look through the catalog and see what's available. Some of these varieties are sold out, but I think most of the ones that are doing well in the South, they're still available. So check it out, Old House Gardens. You can also ask me about the other bulbs as we get into it. Hey, I know we have some callers. Let me see here. I got so many things I'm looking at. Here we go. Bill, I'm listening. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, good morning. Listen, I have some pine cone ginger that I planted last year, and I do love them, but I planted a few, and boy, do I have a lot. And what I would like to do is just dedicate a part of the yard to my ginger garden, let's say. But my question is, when is the best time to dig them up and transplant them?
Yeah. You know, they're one of those plants that are going to do pretty well no matter when you do it. I think this is a good time to do it. I think it'll be fine to do it now. It won't hurt. You got plenty of season left on the Gulf Coast for them to get established. They'll actually like the warm soil. The one thing you have to do is you have to remember to water when mm-hmm. you transplant them. But they'll probably do pretty well now, reasonably well. They would do just as well just before the foliage begins emerging in spring, if you can remember doing that. So sometime in April or May, the problem is the plants won't emerge, and so you may forget where they are. But in this case, I think just because you know where they are, you can see the plants, you won't lose track of them. I think this is a fine time to do it.
All right, as an example, if they did die back in the wintertime or when it starts getting cold, would that be too late to dig up the – well, they're not bulbs, are they? What are they, rhizomes?
They're rhizomes, yeah. So it's not too late to do it in winter. It's just that they're not going to do any root growth, and the roots will be slightly more susceptible to freezing and to diseases because they're not actively growing. It won't hurt to do it then. I'd say the best time is probably after the soil starts to warm, just in March. And if you can find the bulbs just before they start emerging, you can certainly, the rhizomes, and you know where exactly where they are, mid-March, late March, great time to do it, and then you can move them around. Again, you need to water. It's the downside of doing it in winter is that they're just not going to do any root growth. I think this is probably a fine time to move them, to spread them around a little bit. You're going to disrupt you're going to disrupt the blooming a little bit. But if you don't want to disrupt the blooming, just, you know, mark where they are, come back in March and move them in March, late March.
All right, good advice. Thank you.
All right, Bill. Good to hear from you. David Melitol.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I was going to call and we're going to follow up from last week with the unknown item creatures that were eating my Melitol leaves.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. You know, it's one of those things where you can't see them. It's so annoying. You go and you see the damage, and you can't see them. Sometimes it's beetles, sometimes it's worms, and sometimes the worms hide out. Sometimes they're just not visible. Sometimes you'll get lots of teeny tiny worms. So, David, managed to get a picture. It looked to me from the picture, my best guess was that it was a cabbage looper of some type, one of the cabbage loopers. Did you ever see the thing move, David?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I saw them. I found after using your suggestion of using a flashlight and kind of going out there at dusk, I found that first big one. And then as I started looking, I won't say they all popped out, but I could see a bunch of them, smaller ones with little webbing going down. And so, yeah, I saw at least a handful of them. And it's like I said, they blend in so well with the green. But once I found them and kind of knew what to look for. And in fact, I think I told you, one of your other listeners, Rob, who's also grown melitol, he sent me some pictures of his damage. And after I sent him of the cabbage looper picture, he also found some on his as well. So I don't know why they're suddenly interested in melitol, but.
Yeah, and I'm a little interested in, you know, we don't break down species very well. We just, and there's a bunch of species out there. I'm not sure this is the traditional cabbage looper. It may be a little different. As nearly as I can tell from the picture, it is a cabbage looper. You know, one of the things that loopers will do is when their body moves, they'll make that little hump in the center, sort of like an upside down U, and that's the loop. So if you see that, you know it's probably in that genus. But I'm a little concerned it might be a different type of cabbage looper. But it's obviously going after plants that are, in that family, which is a little unusual, I think. Mm-hmm. But then not a lot of people that we know grow melitol. So it may be that it happens a lot and we just don't hear about it except in some years. One thing, David, can I ask you how much of the foliage has been eaten by these caterpillars?
I'm thinking maybe a fifth or a sixth. It's the first part I see when I approach it, so it looks a lot, looks like a lot. But as you know, I step back after I'd sprayed for it. Most everything else seems to be okay. And I think, you know, also it's kind of also fighting with the hot days of August that we just went through is kind of also causing a little stress on the leaves too. But I think so far after spraying, it looks like I'm down to, you know, it only got to about a fifth of it at best.
Yeah. And, you know, there is a threshold. It's a commonly used threshold, and it's been kind of worked out for a lot of plants, and it's pretty good number, 30%. So when you get close to a third, when you start getting close to a third of the foliage damaged, then it's going to have a real impact on your harvest. At 20% or less, probably not a big deal. Between 10 and 20% damage, you know, you don't have to panic. You don't want it to get out of hand, but if you're just seeing a few leaves damaged, you don't worry about it. And we're going to come back, David. Hold on, because I want to ask you what you sprayed with. So we're going to hold on. We're going to be right back. Let that music play.
their loved ones and their brothers in arms. So it went for Joseph Warren.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
To the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I move into the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches.
Okay, we heard you.
To the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches.
Let's get back to this. You know, if you're gonna move the country, you ought to eat a lot of persimmons. Seems to me they're starting to fall in various places. It's fun to look for them. Talk to me about persimmons sometime, a good thing. David Hubble's on the line. David is a great cook, an aficionado of many things from Louisiana. All things Louisiana. Is that fair, David?
Well, and, South Louisiana, probably.
South Louisiana, that's right. We don't acknowledge the... Well, you should. It's some beautiful stuff up in North Louisiana. Those beautiful longleaf pine woods. Incredible things up there, too. So David is big on growing melaton, and he's kind of the melaton king right now, the Gulf Coast. I think that's fair to say. He's done a lot to keep the melaton tradition alive all along the Gulf Coast. And to connect people, you know, that's one of the great things David does. And that's one of the most important things anybody can do is connect people. And David connects people. And that's really nice on this great melaton tradition. He also just does wonderful cooking things. But David had some bugs on his melaton. Y'all know what melaton is. It's that beautiful thing, the alligator pear, the thing that's like a cross between a pear and a squash, as I like to say. Everybody has a different description. Something that really can only be grown well along the Gulf Coast. We can talk about it more, but David had bugs on it. We had to figure it out. And sometimes bugs are hard to find because they hide. It's often good to go out at night. They're a little more... they ain't so timid at night, and it's easier to find them if it's, and so David took the flashlight out. He found them. They dropped from little stringy strands. Is that right, David? They would drop from the strands when they were frightened.
But they were dropping.
That's just one of their little techniques. It's really cool. They'll just drop on a little thread. Down from the leaf, which makes it harder to see. I mean, it's just a little technique they got. And then they'll spin up a little cocoon and a little pattern of threads, too. But I'm pretty sure they were cabbage loopers of one type or another. And we got some damage. David, you sprayed. What'd you spray with? Can I ask?
Sure. Now, I was going to also add before that the other telltale that we found was all the droppings that they left behind.
Right. And that's why I say don't. Don't go in looking for the caterpillars first. Go in looking for the poop.
Yeah.
And I have to say that out loud, because it's true. The poop is always visible, even when the caterpillars aren't.
Yeah, they're pretty prolific at it too. So initially, when I saw them, I think it might have been the Saturday before last. I don't use a lot of pesticides at all on the melaton. I've had a beetle activity once in a while, but it's never been bad, so I try not to really use anything on it.
Yeah.
But the only thing I had in my garage was an old bottle of Malathion, which I didn't really care for because of the smell, but I sprayed that initially, and the next day or so when I went back, it looked like it hadn't done anything to stop it. And that was before we figured out what it was. And then I went, after talking to you, I went into the store and I got Thuricide, but I didn't get to use it. Instead, I used Liquid 7, and it seemed to have done the job at halting the progress. So the last several days, I've not seen any droppings or any more leaf degradation.
Yeah. So what happens is, and this is really important to understand, is generally those pesticides aren't good at killing the really big ones. They're going to continue to eat. What they do is they kill that younger generation, and that's true for almost any pesticide you use. Well, it's true for every pesticide you use. The bigger ones will just keep on for a while. The younger ones are the ones that get affected. And so you want to try to – that's why it's, I always say squish the big ones, then apply BT for the small ones. But that's what happened. The 7 basically wiped out – maybe the Malathion too, that younger generation. The older generation had a pretty short cycle. The older generation went ahead and cocooned up, metamorphosed into moths and flew away. But they weren't replaced by a younger generation. And that's probably about what happened. BT would have done the same job pretty well and be a little safer. 7 in Malathion, that's a good question. I think they're... among the chemical pesticides, they're good because they're short-lived. That's the nicest thing I can say about them. They're short-lived. They don't cause a lot of problems after a while. So unlike a lot of other pesticides, which can keep causing problems, and so they're somewhat safer than some of the others. They probably have low mammalian toxicity as well. So,
I was going to say, part of the reason I chose those is that because of my, getting home from work after 6 o'clock and
that's right.
trying to thwart any further degradation to the leaves, I had to do something that hopefully was going to work. But I got the thuricide that next time I can mix it up and apply that first if I need to. And the good thing, also like what you're saying too, is that another 3 weeks we should start seeing Melitol blooms and flowers. So hopefully by that time, everything will have run its course before actually fruit bearing on there.
Yep. And when you start seeing the flowers, you definitely don't want to be spraying things like Malathion and 7, which can have a big impact on pollinators.
Yeah.
And not a good thing. Not a good thing when you're trying to get your fruit pollinated. So right. BT will work really well. But I think you're probably right. I mean, we're kind of on a hump now. So, David, I want to talk about something else.
Sure.
I'm obsessed with it. Phyllo.
Okay.
And sassafras. I think we forget that sassafras is so important to Southern cuisine, one of the great missing ingredients of Southern cuisine. How often do you encounter phyllo powder in recipes in Louisiana and in your tradition?
I mean, primarily in the poultry or chicken andouille type of gumbos. Just as you were saying, like with respect to seasonal gumbos, things like seafood and okra were usually done in the summertime, because that was you would have had the okra. I guess you could have dried okra too and saved some of that. But phyllo usually, it'll be described in the recipe too. You make your modern gumbos, have you making a roux first, and then you put all that other ingredients in there. And then at the end is when you add the phyllo, because you don't want to put too much, because people describe it as getting ropey or stringy.
Ropey or stringy. Yeah, boy, this was getting good, David. This is getting really good. And now I got to take a break. David, it's good to hear from you. We'll be back. I'm going to talk a little bit more about sassafras in our next segment. Listen up and call back in if it interests you. Good.
Okay.
Hey, we're going to take a break. 343-0106. We're going to be back. Hold on.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yes, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. There's some great work that's been done on understanding some of the foods we eat in the South. And, you know, many of them neglect the seasonality problem. That is that, look, I don't want to sound academic here. Let me just tell you, you can't get okra in winter. There's a season to things. There's a season to cooking. You didn't traditionally in the South. I know you can go to restaurants now and they got it all, whatever. Greenhouse okra, frozen okra. I don't know how they do it. It ain't right. Ain't that good either. You want it fresh. Okra needs the heat. It needs the heat. And so gumbos varied with seasons. Gumbo probably came from many traditions. That's also important to understand, I think, for gardeners. We tend to think that gardening really, we tend to feature the vegetables that were sacralized. How do I say this? That were blessed by European countries like Germany and Italy, England, France. We forget about the foods that really are great North American foods and the ways of preparing those. And one of the good things about okra and gumbo and that tradition and filet is that it combines all of those traditions, African, European, Native American, into one dish. I think they all converged there in various ways, and they were probably converged multiple times in multiple ways. Really cool. I want to talk about filet because, you know, you ain't stopped me yet. If you want to stop me, you give me a call. We'll talk about something. But I want to talk about filet. You know, it interested people enough that I did get a call. You know, filet is sassafras leaves. And sassafras leaves are one of the nicest things in the world to eat. Very safe, really wonderful flavor if you've never had sassafras leaves. I'm going to tell you something. And David, I'm going to mention this, and then we're going to come back to melatonin, maybe talk about it a little more on the show too. But if you haven't tried this, David, I think I'm going to call this traditional Southern food. When you're grilling, whatever, fish, it's great with fish. When you're grilling fish, when you're grilling chicken, perfect for chicken, pork chops, whatever it is you're doing, anything that's got a little fat and that you need to cook a little bit slow, at least deep into the process. So let's say you're going to char your chicken on the grill, get that outside a little toasty, dry it out a little bit. Take a bed of sassafras leaves. Listen to this. I'm telling you, this is unbelievably good. This is unbelievably Southern, too. Take a bed of sassafras. Why is it Southern? Because I did it. And because it came out of the yard. Take a bed of sassafras leaves and you don't have to grind them up. You don't have to dry them. In fact, soak them in water. Soak them in water just to get them a little extra wet. Lay it on the grill. Lay it on your Weber grill, right? Whatever. Not over the flames directly, but off the flames. Take your chicken, put it on those sassafras leaves. It'll keep the chicken from heating too much. Keep it from sticking to the grill so you don't lose your meat. You don't lose your skin. It's just a beautiful thing. Slows the heat down a little bit. The moisture keeps it, helps just a little bit from those leaves. And those leaves just give an incredible flavor. And they absorb all those wonderful juices from the chicken. And then you know what you do? When you take your chicken off, you take those sassafras leaves and you just put them there as a vegetable accompaniment. They are absolutely delicious. My favorite part about cooking chicken on the grill is to get to eat the sassafras leaves. Oh, goodness gracious, are they so good. Delicious. How do you make filet? You know, I don't know. You dry it, you grind it. You know, I don't even know how you dry them, honestly. I hadn't thought about that. It probably is something you'd want to do in fall when the rains have stopped. But you can't do it too late in fall because the leaves will have lost all their juice. But while they're still green, pick them, dry them. You might have smoked them traditionally. I don't even know the answer to that. Some people may. But, you know, you don't have to enjoy sassafras leaves, which are one of the great flavors around. One great traditional flavor. Try that with your chicken. Try it on the grill. Really delicious. There's an old thing, and it's kind of crazy, and I have to mention this because somebody will yammer about it. FDA, many years back, decided that sassafras roots could cause cancer in rats because of something that was really highly concentrated in the roots called safrol, and which is also in lots of other things that you use in the kitchen, probably in as quantities about as high as you would get in sassafras leaves. But they picked on sassafras roots, excuse me, and they can't be sold as a food commodity. And since there wasn't a big wealthy constituency selling sassafras roots, nobody really ever complained. It never got taken off. But I will tell you that I doubt safrol is a big deal. It's in many ingredients and many plants that you're using in your kitchen. But it's not highly concentrated in the leaves. So somebody says, oh, this is – no, it's not. It's ridiculous. It's like saying tomatoes cause cancer. Well, they can because of some of the chemical components if you extract them in really extract them and feed them in high concentrations. I expect it could. Lemons could cause cancer if you did the same thing. Sassafras, enough of that. Sassafras, incredible thing, incredible part of our cooking. Safrol is in, I think it's in nutmeg. Don't use nutmeg anymore if you're going to worry about cancer. That's ridiculous. Don't worry about it. Ain't going to cause cancer. And it's a beautiful thing to cook with. I wish I hadn't even had to say that. Beautiful thing to cook with. Beautiful thing to cook with. David said he's used that grilling technique with sage and bay leaves. Yeah, and it works well. You know, the great thing about sassafras leaves is if you got them around, you got a lot of them. David, you know, even up on your hill where you are, there ought to be the little sassafras shrubs all around. You'll see them a lot. I know they're over at the botanical gardens, good number of them. Really fun to use, usually abundant some. Do it with grape leaves, too. It's just that... And you can eat the grape leaves, and they're good. It's just that grape leaves aren't quite as good as those sassafras leaves. Oh, man, are they good. Are they ever good? Yeah, and sassafras teas made from the roots, another thing. Hey, listen, I wanted to – Jim is sending me a picture of something. He says his grandma went in the woods and got sassafras roots to make teas. I think that's a cool thing. The leaves are just as good. Really great. I love the leaves. But Jim sent me a picture of a plant that's blooming now. It's blooming in many places throughout Alabama. It's one of Alabama's most important plants. Quail love it. Partridge pea was the old name. Partridge. Because quail were called partridge, right? You may not have heard that, but that's one of the old names. Partridge pea, really important native plant. Camacrista, is that the genus? There are several species within there. It's a really important plant in the South. I guarantee you my buddy Sean wants to see that stuff growing in his pasture on the edges where he's got the where he wants to have quail. Partridge pea. Partridge pea. Did I say it right? Great plant. Great plant for it's an annual. Most of them are. At least that one is. I can tell is the annual version of it. Comes back every year from seed. Quail love the seed. That's what you got. That's what you got. And David, I'm going to come back and look. I haven't had a chance. So let's see. What are we? Oh, it's coming through. From different people, I think the roots drying make a wonderfully hard root beer from Jim in Georgetown. Yes, indeed. And the roots are really great that way. Oh, man, did we talk our way through that? I know we got some callers. I'm coming back. Hold on, folks. Want to get that sassafras thing done. Mary Alice, I'm coming back. James, I'm coming back.
And waving black hair, with the roses so red and the lilies so fair.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, diamonds are all come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Somehow surviving every year. Hey, that's enough. That's enough. You can turn it down. Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. Listen, so it's fun. So we got to talk about sassafras. Rusty, which is a great thing to cook with. And Jim in Georgetown, I didn't get Jim's picture, so I wasn't quite sure where he was coming from. His picture finally came through. It's slow how things happen slowly sometimes on the internet. Has to squeeze through them little lines, and sometimes it takes a while for it to squeeze through. And his picture came through, and what he's doing is he's drying the leaves. It looks like a beautiful quilt, doesn't it, Jim, when you do that? He's drying the leaves, using them to make a root beer that, you know, Jim does those kinds of things all the time. And it does make a wonderful root beer. But there's so many great uses for sassafras leaves. Rusty pointed out, and Mary Alice, James, hold on just a second. I want to get this out of my head here and into your heads. Rusty pointed out that there's a thing called laurel wilt. L-A-U-R-E-L. That it's a wilt that's affecting trees in the laurel family. You know, kind of like Laurel, Mississippi, you know, the little community of Laurel, which we talk about a bit. Laurel was named because there were so many different kinds of laurel growing around it, I guess. In the South, we have a lot of laurel, members of the laurel family growing in the South. Sassafras is one of them. Red bay is another. Really important tree, really important native spice. There's a couple of kinds of red bay. Avocado, actually, believe it or not, is a close relative and is a type of laurel in the laurel family, Laurelaceae. And spice bush is another. A lot of them out there. We had a disease come through that's really affecting a lot of the laurels. It's a disease carried by a certain type of insect. It's just really decimating the trees, decimating sassafras trees and red bay trees. And that's too bad. I think one of the good things is, and there aren't many good things about this, and it really is a sorry, sorry, sorry thing we do to ourselves when we do this to ourselves, bring in these diseases without even thinking about it. Just dirty, dirty, dirty people. You know, the way we bring in diseases. Take a bath every night, but bring in every disease known to man. Listen, laurel wilt's affecting trees, but Rusty, the good thing is that it only affects larger stems, effectively speaking. And a lot of plants may be able to survive. Red bay may be able to survive as a sprout. And so we'll still be able to use it. It won't survive as a tree, but it will survive as a sprout. Sassafras the same way. And on the Gulf Coast, sassafras has almost always been, you rarely see a really big sassafras. There have always been a number of diseases that kind of hollowed them out. And the big trees, pretty susceptible to problems. But sassafras will survive as a sprout. And the bugs that get into the bugs that spread this disease around, they don't like those thinner stems. They're looking for fatter stems. So we'll be able to keep sassafras around as a sprout. We won't see it as a tree. The trees perhaps less often as a tree. And that's really sad because sassafras trees are amazing things. Incredibly beautiful. The flowers are incredibly beautiful. Just the leaves are beautiful. The color is beautiful. The trunk is this beautiful orange. The wood is this beautiful orange. Really makes an incredibly long-lasting wood. One of the most long-lasting woods out there. It's one of those woods people used to use as fence posts because it would last so long. Kind of a waste of really good wood, if you ask me, but, you know, that just gives you a sense of how long it lasted. I hope that the sassafras trees in a little farther north survive this, and we hope they do. But the leaves will still have. You should look for them. Learn to recognize sassafras leaves. If you don't know how to tell a sassafras leaves, you call me. We're going to talk about that. James, we need to talk about your issue here with this live oak and a water oak. Tell me about it.
The live oak, you know, want to keep, of course, it's about 16 to 18 inches at the base. And then the water oak's growing out the side of the base. It's probably about 8 inches.
Yeah.
I want to cut it out the way and see how it could save the live oak.
Yeah. So, yeah, and the water oak can indeed outgrow the live oak if you're not careful. And I, you know, there's nothing wrong with just cutting that water oak back. It will continue to sprout a little bit from the base. I'm trying to think the best way to handle this that's safe. Here's what I think I would do. Cut that water oak back to about 2 feet.
Right.
From the base of the live oak. And you'll have a bare area right there on top where you cut it off. take some Roundup. You can mix it with water and just paint it carefully where you cut it. Almost just within 24 hours of cutting that tree, paint it right there where you cut it.
On the surface.
And then on the surface. And then, for good measure, take a little piece of plastic, just black plastic, cut it, put it around the top of that stump with a rubber band. That's what Tommy Dodd taught me to do, and I think it helps it a little bit, keeps the Roundup from getting washed off, helps it to absorb a little better, and it will translocate into the roots, and it's more likely that that tree, the water oak, will die. It's not going to move into the live oak, however, because I don't think the roots have been fused, so I don't think you'll see that problem, because generally the two don't fuse. Yeah.
But don't use salt, right? I mean, it might hurt the water oak.
Don't use salt?
Yeah.
Salt, you said?
That's what I'm asking. I mean, I've heard somebody say that salt will kill anything.
Well, yeah, right. Well, no. I mean, no. Just ignore that.
Okay.
There's too many reasons. There's too many reasons why that's wrong. Too many. You would have to use... Yeah, you'd have to use a truckload of salt to kill that water oak effectively, and you'd have to get it all around the roots, and then you'd kill everything else, and then you'd have to wait for the rains to dissipate the salt. It would be the worst idea you could possibly do.
And then probably kill the live oak.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. If you had enough salt to kill the water oak, it would probably do damage to the live oak, though both of them are going to be pretty salt tolerant. I actually don't think you would have enough salt to kill the trees. You'd have to have a whole lot, but you would kill everything else. So you'd kill the grasses. And you don't want to do that.
Understood.
It's just a bad idea. Yeah.
I'm listening to you for a reason. So thank you.
All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, just whoever gave you that advice, don't take any more horticultural advice from them.
Oh, what I'm going to do is I'm gonna punch him in the mouth. How about that?
Yeah, don't do that. They're probably good for other things, you know. They're probably good for other things.
No, I appreciate that.
But that
much,
bad horticultural advice.
All right. Yes, thank you.
All right, James. Call me back if you got any more problems there. Mary Alice, let's try to start this conversation. We may have to come back after the break, but I'm listening. Tell me about this. You got a pecan tree? Where is it?
Yeah, it's in front of our house, and it has a large limb that's hanging over our roof, and we have other pecan trees on our property that are dropping limbs like crazy, so we think we probably just need to take it down, but we want to have a replacement tree for that area in our yard to keep shade and just to look beautiful. And so we didn't know if you had any recommendations. We have a couple that we like the look of online or maybe just around town that we've seen, but we just wanted your thoughts. So the ones that we are Ginkgo, wisteria trees, birch trees, or maybe jacaranda, if I'm saying that correctly.
So the last is a the last one is a tropical tree that will not grow well for you at all. In fact, okay. You won't grow it. I'm going backwards. Birch, not a great tree for you either. And there's this banjo thing. So we got to listen to the banjos and then we got to take a break, but I'm coming back. Can you hold on and let's talk our way through this? Okay?
See what I can do. I'm trying to get to 11 o'clock math, but I'll try.
Oh, look at that. It'll only be just a second.
Okay.
Cornbread and butter beans, and you cross the table. Eating beans and I'm making love as long as I am able.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, welcome back. Let's get to this. Lots of tree questions this morning, and I want to get back to sassafras. But Mary Alice has some pecan trees that are dropping limbs, as they're prone to do. And there's some great choices out there. Mary Alice, how far from your house is this tree that you want to, the spot where you want to put the tree?
I'm thinking it's probably like 10 or 12 feet from the house. I'm not the best estimator.
Oh, man. Be very careful. That's pretty close. 10 or 12 feet, really.
Let me clarify from my husband while you're thinking.
Yes. So here's what I would say, and let me make it really simple so you don't have to go out and measure. Anything within 25 feet of your house, you want to be really careful about. You live on the Gulf Coast. You're going to have lots of hurricanes, tropical storms. A lot of trees are vulnerable. Do not choose a tree based on pretty. Choose a tree based on how is this tree going to survive next to my house? Or is it going to do damage if it falls over? So there are two ways of approaching that. And I know you got to go to mass, but listen, you got to think about this, and you may have to call me back next week. But here's what you got to think about. You do not want a tree that gets big enough to do damage to your house. That close.
Right.
That's really, really important. So choose a smaller flowering tree that doesn't do damage if it falls over. Choose a palm, it can be that close to the house without causing any problems, no matter how big it gets. Most palms are just fine. Or choose something else, but that close to the house. None of the plants that you said I would trust, not ginkgo, not any of those. You want to be really careful about that. So now what you need to do, and go on, you got to get to mass. But listen, Mary Alice, look for some smaller trees. Call me back next week. Let's talk about what some other solutions are there. That might be a great place to put a fruit tree. You could put a fig there. You could put a persimmon there, that big Japanese persimmon with grapefruits. You could just walk out the door, and there's the tree. And that tree's not going to cause any problems to your house. So it's you might even could try a citrus tree, even though we got some citrus season. But all those things are really great ideas. But don't put a big tree there. Don't put a big canopy tree there because you're going to endanger your house.
Okay, thank you. And the wisteria one, I was interested in that look. It doesn't look like it gets very big, but I also don't want an invasive vine. But this online, it looked like it truly was just a tree. But
yeah, don't Don't trust those pictures. Okay. And don't ever trust Asian wisteria. You don't want that. I hear what you're looking for. I think I can make you happy with some trees. Chaste tree, C-H-A-S-T-E. Chaste tree could be a very nice one. It's a smaller tree. Has that, it will have that bluish quality of wisteria, can be very beautiful. That could be very nice. Silver Bells could be a very nice place. Chionanthus, the fringe tree, could do very well there if you want just beautiful flowers. You know, I love persimmons because they're beautiful all through the year. The fruits themselves are such colorful things. You almost think of them as flowers. Citrus trees, many citrus trees could do very well there in all likelihood. And you can call me back about which ones, and we can talk about how to find them in this treacherous times when we have some citrus diseases running through. But I think you're still okay to find some. They have flowers, they have fragrance, they have fruits, they have great evergreen foliage. They won't cause damage to your house. So there's a lot of really cool things that could work. Wisteria is not one of them.
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate it. And just a little lanyap moment, but I do have a Confederate rose plant that was gifted to me, and it's starting to get about 6 to 8 feet, and it has like 5 or 6 stems. Could I braid those and kind of make it into one stem, and it could be more like a tree, or should I just leave it as a bush with multiple, pieces?
Yes, you could braid them, but then you're going to have to start over again next year because the stems often don't last through the winter. So,
okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Yeah, so it won't work. It won't work. It'll be cool, but it won't work. Let me think about this. You call me back next week when you have more time, so you're not going to mass. Call me in that first hour, and let's talk about it a little more. Did I lose you, Mary Alice? She ran off. She got to go to mass. Let's talk about that next week. So good, good. I think that's all of our callers. Let's get back up here. So listen, let me talk about wisteria for a minute. And I didn't say this. Jim in Georgetown said this, and you don't trust me, but you can trust Jim in Georgetown. Jim says wisteria eats fences and is almost impossible to kill. It would eat her house if she's not careful. Jim, here's my only addition. Even if she is careful, it's going to eat her house. You know what I'm saying? Because it's impossible. It sprouts everywhere. Now, let me also add, and this is very important, very, very important, that is the Asian wisteria. Nothing wrong with being an Asian wisteria, except it goes berserk when it gets here in the South. And there's a lot of reason it goes berserk. It's bad. You know, originally when people planted wisteria in the South, they planted the native wisteria. And it's interesting. We got a beautiful native wisteria. It grows all along the Alabama River. It grows all along the Pascagoula. It's a beautiful thing. Grows up to Tom Bigbee, at least where we hadn't. Yeah, it does in places where we hadn't, where the Corps of Engineers and everything else hadn't screwed it up there. Excuse me for saying that out loud. But it grows along our rivers. And it's a beautiful native wisteria. If it's along the highway, it's the Asian wisteria. Mm-hmm. Our highways are like, you see what happens. It's this disturbed habitat, and Asian wisteria loves it. But you don't want to plant that in your yard. The native wisteria is fine. It doesn't spread. It's easy. It's one of the nicer vines you can grow. There's some great cultivars out there. They're hard to find, but there's some great ones out there. So just that caveat. But let me tell you, for your purposes, Mary Alice, for your purposes, for what you're trying to achieve, I don't think you want to use wisteria. If you wanted to shade the windows of your house, I could help you. That might make sense. We could put up a trellis. We could grow the native wisteria. But you don't want to use those tree wisterias. The deception of the internet is that you could somehow do that. That ain't going to happen. Oh, it's going to be a royal mess. A royal mess. Jim in Georgetown, just Just tell her, Jim, it's going to be a royal mess. Don't do it. But we got some other things. We got other great things, and I hope we have a chance to talk about that. So David reminded me of this with gumbo. The Langlois, Madame Langlois, Bienville's, did I get that right? Did I come close? there's lots of ways. I've heard people up here who have the name Langlois pronounce it Langlois. Langlois. Is that close, David? I'm terrible at it, but I'm trying. She was Bienville's cook, and she played a really important role. And as David says, some say it was in Mobile when she was cooking for Bienville in Mobile. And some say it was in New Orleans about how to use Gulf Coast ingredients. And she helped to bring some of those elements in. At least that's the story. I think that's probably true. And if it is true, it probably also means that, well, we could assume that gumbo has a Native American heritage before it had an African-American heritage, if she had something like gumbo. It's an interesting thing, but clearly what we know as gumbo is a cross-section of European, African, and Native American traditions. I think it's worth appreciating all of them and all of their contributions. And that means gumbo is going to be a lot of different things, but gumbo was always a lot of different things. It could be green gumbo. It could be a bouillabaisse. It could be, it could be chicken and squirrel, which would be called something else if you were farther north from the coast. Brunswick stew, maybe, you know? But it was gumbo on the Gulf Coast with thickeners, and so it's interesting. And I love the – but what it comes down to is understanding how people wanted to thicken it, to me. And there were several ways of doing it. So, Langlois. So, yeah, we'll have to have David's going to come on the air, and he's going to pronounce it for us. Gumbo is gumbo. That's right. That's right, says Dave. That's right. Gumbo is gumbo. And there's a lot of different ways here along the Gulf Coast to think about it. What is that? Is that a beautiful cactus from Rodney? It's just beautiful looking. What an incredible flower. What an incredible flower. You'll have to tell me which cactus that is. I don't know. It's a beautiful thing, Rodney. Let me know. Let's see here. What have I... So, David B. up in... David said he was... They took him up in the woods. I'm going to tell the story. Because we're still stuck on sassafras. David took me up in the woods. Somebody took David up in the woods around Rufter Mountain, and they showed him this big tree, a gigantic tree, and they said it was sassafras. And David said, "Is that the same thing?" I said, "Yeah." So here's the thing: in the old days, sassafras used to get really, really big, and it grew as it got bigger. It was slow growing. So C.B. Carl says to me, "Yeah, well, sassafras was the bow wood of the creeks, and I think it probably was among many trees that were used for bow wood, along with bodark, and some other trees. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about the difference between those old sassafras and the new sassafras when we come back."
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days. My world is a flood.
All right. Listen, we got lots of things to clear up here in this last little segment. So it is interesting. Those of us whose tongues weren't born speaking French have a hard time wrapping around some of those words. Sometimes we hear them growing up. We try to learn them. And I think there was some simplification of French words, certainly along the Gulf Coast, as French speakers encountered other languages. So how you pronounce names like Langlois, that's a lot of, your tongue's doing a lot of things. So in French, it might be something closer to Langlois. As David says, along the Gulf Coast, Langlois is probably a little easier to say, and maybe how it was often pronounced here. You might also hear Langlois. So a lot of different names. But one of the great cooks, the really important cook of the Gulf Coast, bringing Bienville, the founder of Mobile and New Orleans, into this Gulf Coast Native American tradition that we've forgotten so much about. It would be so fun to use it. Sassafras trees are one of those trees that we talked about that I think we've lost as part of our cuisine, and really delicious, delicious as a bed for like slow cooking chicken, slow cooking even meats and pork chops. When you're on the grill, just lay it on top, and then the taste of those leaves is so beautiful. It's a great vegetable once you've cooked it cooked it in those juices. Really delicious. Really a wonderful thing. I think very good for you. Sassafras leaves. We mostly have shrubby sassafras along the Gulf Coast for a lot of reasons. And I think it was wise for them to adapt to a shrubby lifestyle with lots of fires. As you move farther north, they tend to become more tree-like. I have seen some very big sassafras trees along the banks of the Alabama River in Mobile County. One of the biggest I've ever seen was at the site of Old Mobile. Probably not there anymore. Goodness gracious, who knows what's happened there over the years. But it was immense tree. But up around Birmingham, you still see a lot of really large trees, really large sassafras trees up to Huntsville, all through the Black Belt, there'll be some really big ones too. And they can get really big, 24 inches, beautiful wood. The older wood, C.B. Carl, was actually probably better for bows because it was really, the wood was really dense. The rings were really close together. I think the modern wood is more brittle and probably would take special treatment to make a good bow out of it. But I think you're probably right. I think the older wood was used along with several other woods for bows along the Gulf Coast. Okra, okra is there's a great argument about how everybody's going to fry it. But let me tell you, raw okra is one of the great blessings to mankind. I will just tell you, it is absolutely wonderful and delicious. You don't have to cook okra. Put raw okra in a salad. It won't be slimy. It won't do any of those things that you think you don't like. It's delicious that way. It's great roasted. It's a wonderful thing to roast okra. Beautiful way to do it. Here's another trick with okra. I don't know what you call this dish. Cook your rice. Let the rice, you're going to cook your rice about 15 minutes, maybe 20. About 5 minutes into cooking your rice, throw some okra on top of it. You don't have to cut it up. You don't have to do anything. Just throw it on top of the rice. Put the lid back on it. Let it cook. Let it steam. Beautiful way to do okra. Salt, put a little salt on it when you take it out. Delicious that way. There's so many great ways to do okra. We are so tukey, as my grandmother said. I don't know where that word came from, but there it is. Tukey about what we'll eat. And okra is delicious. What a great discovery. What a great thing to do. Bimble didn't find anything, says Dave from Gulf Shores. I'm looking for his whole message. So that's right. Well, the cities were the foundation, not the place. And Mobile is still ultimately a city more than it is a place. And I could really get into that. It doesn't learn from where it is. It doesn't learn from where it is the way it should. Neither does New Orleans in a lot of ways. It seeks to, our modern versions of these cities are to put as much distance as we can between the land and the city. And that's a shame. But Bienville did found those two cities in a really important ways. Not the land. The land was not his to found. He did not discover the land. He did not even really probably ever understand the land, though I would suspect he probably had a more intimate acquaintance with than those of us who've lived here most of our lives, because he had to in a way. But yes, the cities, I think I can argue he did found. The land he did not find. The land had been here for a long time, inhabited by lots of people, many nations, with many names we forget. Pensacola and the Pascagoula tribes, the Biloxi tribes, whose languages we forget, who were not Creek or Choctaw. Naniaba. The fish eaters north of Mobile, incredibly important. The Alabama, really important tribe. The Coasati throughout Alabama. I wish we could remember all those names. The Apalachee, the Uchi. People throughout the state of Alabama whose names we've forgotten, who are so important here. And their traditions we lost. So a great thing. So I do get a little bit of reward for talking about raw sliced okra on salads and fancy ramen. Yeah, really good. You know, I think there's probably an okra pasta. I'm thinking about it, and I did the other day. I put it – don't cook it too much. You don't need to cook it too much. You just cook it lightly. Cut it up. You can slice it in long pieces. There's so many fun ways to use okra. Using it with peppers is really good. Using it with tomatoes is great. If you've got some fresh tomatoes, you got more tomatoes than you know what to do with. But there's so many great ways to cook okra. Please don't get stuck on just fried okra. You lose a lot of the quality of the okra, and it's really hard to do well. Some restaurants, even restaurants with fry baskets don't really know how to do it. To get fried okra right, you need a big black skillet. And you need a lot of patience. A lot of patience to do it right. We can show you how to do it. But listen, fried okra ain't the only way to do okra. I don't even crave fried okra anymore. I crave all of the other types of okra. Somebody has said to me, don't forget bay leaf. Bay leaf is, red bay is a relative of sassafras. It's one of our most important spice trees. It was the bay leaf of the Gulf Coast. I hope we don't forget it. I hope we don't lose it to our diseases. Winter, that's the name of this song. I think it's probably good. I see it coming on. It's a while away, but I can see it coming on. We're going to be back next week. Give us a call.